Senate Committee on the Judiciary, April 27th, 1977, work session, 3 p.m., room 346.
We'll start with 3172.
I'll move the floor's amendment. Have we moved the amendments yet?
Wait a minute, I want to hear.
Yes. All the amendments are adopted.
Oh, did?
Okay.
3172? We didn't adopt any amendments.
Yes, we did, but we got Bob's amendment.
Where's Hardy?
When did we do that?
We adopted a couple days ago.
Yeah, we adopted just before we sent it. We were going to send out, but the Bruin said no, it was not sent out.
Chairman, could I hear from Mr. Hardy regarding the little program that he was supposed to go back to the Board of Bar Governors?
If you want to. Mr. Hardy?
What was Bob's name?
Oh, yeah. Okay. You have a message for us, Mr. Hardy.
I have a communication.
Very interesting. What do you have to say?
Chairman? Information I received was that the bill in its original form allows the Chief Justice to transfer cases on a case-by-case basis to the Court of Appeals. The bar's feeling about that is that the present Chief Justice cannot bind future Chief Justices. And so, if a hot political case comes along, he could recall the jurisdiction that he had therefore given the Chief Justice good, or could send such a case out. And they feel that it's preferable under this problem that cases be assigned by subject matter and not by individual cases.
These are amendments, sir.
No.
I haven't made any amendments at all.
Diana drafted.
And if it's preferable to assign cases by subject matter, then House Bill 3172 should so say.
So the Board of Bar Governors would then support 3172?
If they are assigned by subject matter, yes.
Well, Mr. Hardy, do you agree with me that the Supreme Court in the next 2 years, in the next 10 days, could transfer all of the appeals to the Court of Appeals, with the exception of constitutional matters?
You mean under present law?
Under this law, which you are supporting.
I really can't answer that because I haven't done anything on this except of this one amendment.
Well, that's what it says, doesn't it? Supreme Court may transfer.
We're talking about A engrossed.
We're talking
or the original bill or B engrossed.
We're talking about a thing I have in my hand, which I can't.
Proposed amendment.
Determine what it is, but it has your amendment in it. That you say you would support.
Yes, I would say that it could send any particular subject matter to the Supreme Court if this amendment was adopted.
The Supreme Court could transfer all appeals.
Yes.
Then how can you support this and not support 3172?
As it's in its present form amended.
Being addressed.
Section
consistent with A. Engrost.
That goes back to the House and the Senate.
They can transfer, in addition to those appeals, over those appeals that the Supreme Court deems appropriate. And that is not the same as saying that they can, by subject matter, because those that they deem appropriate can be an individual case, and they can pick and choose their cases.
No, we're not tracking.
All right.
I understand your amendment, the amendment you support, which I have here. 3172 says that all appeals, with the exception of those that are constitutionally required, will go to the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court will sit only on a writ of appeal.
Court could accomplish the same thing under what we just under this amendment that's here, but the reverse isn't true. They all go here, whereas in the amendment we made, they don't all go there unless the court sends them there. Your statute, House and Gross 3172, says except where original jurisdiction is conferred on the Supreme Court by the Court of Appeals shall have exclusive jurisdiction, and that's not the same as engrossed HB.
It's the same, Herb, if the Supreme Court transfers all the subject matter there.
It is. But I would assume that the Supreme Court is going to retain certain subject matter which they feel would be appropriate.
Why?
What else are they going to have to do except writs of certiorari?
That's exactly what their purpose is, isn't it?
Well, it isn't. It presently isn't their purpose.
It isn't now. That's true.
And
what do you think philosophically ought to be their purpose?
I think ultimately, depending upon the volume, that is the purpose. But I would also say that if I don't think there are enough certiorari cases to keep them, I don't know, but I would assume that that's a question, is whether they're enough to keep them busy. And if you have the right to them to assign additional subject matters, it would be a more gradual process of getting over to the ultimate, which I think is the same as the U.S. Supreme Court's writs of certiorari.
Do you agree that's the way we ought to be going?
I don't think it's a question of whether we agree. I think it's going to come because of the volume of litigation, eventually.
Then let me put it this way to you. If you knew that the Court of Appeals would be manned properly to handle all appeals, and you knew that the Supreme Court could lend any number of its people who were not busy to assist the Court of Appeals in case the workload was too great, would you still worry about the immediate transfer?
I personally would, yes. I don't think it's necessary.
You don't think it's necessary?
No.
But you support this amendment, which says that they can do it next week.
I'm assuming the Supreme Court is not going to transfer them all if it would result in their not having an active docket of one kind or another.
Suppose the flexibility was so that the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, could operate under a flexibility that would give them the right workload. Would that change your mind?
But then now, you understand that I am now discussing this as an individual, because I haven't any authority to discuss this as representing the views of the bar.
That's too bad.
Well, it may be too bad, but it's a fact, Senator, and I don't want to be under any misapprehension, and I don't want the committee to be under any misapprehension, that I am speaking for the bar. You've asked me these questions, I'm trying to give you my views about it.
Good. I'd like to hear them, really.
Well, my views are that I don't think that until the Supreme Court, until the Supreme Court is so overloaded that they have to make that kind of a transfer and take only writs of certiorari of particular cases, should they transfer all jurisdiction now. Now, it's true that they can under the, this amendment, transfer further classifications.
You go to work in the Supreme Court, so I'm asking for two.
You've been scored a few.
The Supreme Court.
Edward, I wouldn't, I haven't any doubt that that's what they're...
That's all I have.
Senator Morris.
If, would it be fair to say that that your position is that by transferring subject matter jurisdiction, that the Supreme Court would transfer, I thought this question was going to help clear up this problem, but that the Supreme Court would then state by category what they were going to transfer.
Right.
And that they wouldn't transfer everything because right now there's not enough certiorari cases to keep them busy.
I would assume that's true. I haven't checked that.
But if we pass the law that they can transfer whatever they want and hold on to what they want, there'd be a tendency to pick and choose because they're going to do more for a while at least than just sit back and wait for certiorari cases.
I think I should kind of give you the view I think that a number of lawyers hold. If you transfer cases from the Supreme Court to the Court of Appeals on a case-by-case basis, you can neither try a case nor write the kind of a brief that you don't know whether you're going into the Court of Appeals or whether you're going into the Supreme Court. And whatever else may be said about it, and with all due respect to both courts, they sometimes develop characters. I don't mean individual characters, but characteristics.
I understand.
In the paper today with respect to the Supreme Court, they claim, there was an article in this morning's paper, that the present Supreme Court has taken on an aura of a former president on the 5-4 votes. And this is the problem that lawyers generally feel is inadvisable, is allowing case by case, in which may be one way one time and one way the next time. But if they're only assigning those cases on general broad categories, then everybody knows that they're going to go to the Court of Appeals on municipal matters. They're going to go to the Supreme Court on the death sentence criminal cases or whatever it may be. And that's the feeling of the very thing I came back and reported to you yesterday. That's the way they feel it ought to be set out in the statute.
So you feel confident that at this time that the Supreme Court will go on hearing other cases beyond certiorari cases, and you want it set out by category what those cases will be rather than a case-by-case determination made?
I would want the cases that are assigned to the Court of Appeals to be by categories. Whatever wasn't assigned,
well, whatever
remains,
wasn't assigned would remain
with
the
Supreme Court. I think that's the thrust of the bar review.
So it's really not as simple as whether or not we're going to assign it all over to the Supreme Court, to the Court of Appeals now.
I'm not as well able to speak on the Supreme Court are, as if they had all the cases taken away from them, where they would be full use of.
Well, how many cert cases did the Supreme Court have in 76? What percentage of their 76 workload was cert cases?
Oh, I imagine a relatively small part, but I don't know.
Less than 40%?
I couldn't say. There are just a problem.
I see.
Senator Corrin. Been my observation in the legislature that there are some bills that fall into many categories because they involve political issues. And it could be put, whether as the Speaker or the President are supposed to assign them according to category, they don't fit, all bills don't fit in any categories. You have a farm labor bill and you can put that in the Labor Committee or you can put it in the Agriculture Committee. And I see the same kind of thing happen with the Supreme Court, and getting right back to your problem of the case-by-case approach. You got a bill on collective bargaining for cities, and you decide that all municipal law cases are going to be held by the Supreme Court and all labor law cases are going to be held by the Court of Appeals. And then they're going to take a look at each individual case, and you're right back in the same situation as before. That makes sense to me for us to make a policy decision that if we're going to transfer that jurisdiction, that we got to do it. But I agree, I think it's a bad situation where they'd be picking their cases individually. Say, well, let's let this one go here and let that go there. And that bothers me. I don't think you get away with it, get away from that problem by going into categories. And cases don't fit in any categories.
That's true to some extent. And yet there are cases of specific...
I'm sure there are, true. There are bills that always go to one committee, too.
Well... I doubt the Supreme Court is quite as political as the state Senate.
There are people that would disagree with
it. Thank you very much, Mr.
None for practice before the Supreme Court.
I haven't yet figured out who the Vern Cook of the Supreme Court is.
I know he's not in this room.
Senator Smith, you have a motion?
Senator Kefauri made the motion, I support it.
What's the motion?
3172 as amended, as far as we pass.
The one that, as you amended it the other day in the engrossed form?
The one that was presently, or was before us when you asked to hold it, let's invite the people back.
Be engrossed.
I'd like to know now how much of the 76 workload of the Supreme Court was certiorari cases.
Judge Hicks, can you answer that? Or Judge Danica?
It's very small. Chairperson, I can, if I may be clear.
Sure.
We had 470 petitions for review filed and had to be considered, but we only granted 43, so we have 43 cases that had to be referred to an opinion that were on petitions for review. We had, other kinds of cases. In other words, where we had to direct, where they would direct appeals to our court. So it would be roughly, my arithmetic's not very good.
300.
Yeah, say a total load of 305, and 43 of those were a total opinion. So 305, and 43 of those were on petitions for review.
Ask another question. Could you comment on Mr. Hardy's remarks about the selective retention of jurisdiction in cases as opposed to categorical retention?
Yes, if I may. What we had visualized in the original bill, and I first realized that it doesn't spell it out, but what we visualized is that the two courts in the trial and appellate bar would get together and work out some categories, just as we have now in the statute categories for the Court of Appeals, and work out categories by which we can transfer to the Court of Appeals enough categories so we take care of about 120 appeals, which is what we would have to get rid of to work without two pro tems, and what we hope that the Court of Appeals would handle with the addition of a total of four more judges. That's the way we have visualized that we would operate under the original bill.
Any further questions? Senator Smith.
However, should 3172 pass as amended, which would transfer all appeals, you would have available, on the basis of need, Supreme Court justices who could assist the Court of Appeals until the workload smoothed out and was fixed and determined. I understand the state of Colorado is it that handles all appeals with 12 justices.
What I think Colorado's 10 and Washington's 12. I'm okay. Not certain about my numbers.
But, yeah. And about the same size states, probably the same kinds of workloads.
I don't think Judge Schwab and I were in the courts. The two courts were certain. If the Court of Appeals were given four additional judges, and we could probably give them at least two pro tem judges. Judge Schwab, I think, expressed his view the other day that probably the Court of Appeals could handle a load of that.
Yes. Thank you.
Further questions? understand.
Then, do you think the predictability problem that Mr. Hardy foresees would not be a problem? When a judge, when a lawyer was preparing his appeal, he could assume that it would start out with a court of appeals?
I don't think the problem would be there. I don't think Mr. Hardy thought it would be there if he was assured, or the bar was assured, that the court and the bar ahead of time would pick out these categories. So that you would know now that I think I gave the example of equity cases, and I tried to make a check, and I couldn't make a very good check as to how many equity cases we have. What we visualize is that something that would be announced way ahead of time, as I say, by the bar and the courts getting together, that equity cases would now all be heard by the Court of Appeal. So the bar would know, and the clients would know, and the lawyers would know that when they tried their case in the lower court, that if the loser wanted to appeal, that case would go to the Court of Appeals.
Further questions, Justice Denneke? Thank you very much.
Madam Chairman.
What is it?
I move that I understand that this insert here was provided to us by Herb Hardy on behalf of the...
No, it was provided by Diana at my direction, and Herb approved of it.
All right. Herb, is this proposed draft something that you think that the bar would support?
I would think so.
Madam Chairman, I would move that we amend B. Engrossed House Bill 3172 to incorporate the language prepared by Diana and approved by Herb Hardy, the representative of the Oregon Bar.
Discussion and motion.
All right. In my discussion, it seems to me that this is a fair compromise between the original proposals and the one made by Senator Smith. I just can't see the historical justification in terms of the development of the issue and the thought and the argument and so on involved to justify our taking this great jump from what previously people had been thinking about as being a court of appeals, perhaps expanded, with the Supreme Court operating with a couple of pro tems. That was the original idea, and possibly based on the Judicial Council, if I have the committee right, whatever it is, the
conference.
Judicial Conference recommendation that there be a study to determine the eventual course. That, I suspect, was the state of things as lawyers and judges thought of it as this legislature met. Now then we had that, one of the bills then came before the House Judiciary Committee, and they make a pretty serious change, which is to abandon the concept of study, I guess that's the result of it, to abandon the concept of study and decide they knew what was all right now without any further study, which is very questionable, I think. Then they send that bill over here that went halfway and gave to the Supreme Court the authority, without any guidelines, to divest itself of some of its kinds of cases. Justice Denneke said they probably had in mind what is in this proposed amendment. Then there was a proposal to do completely away with the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court and have a situation which is made up entirely of the Court of Appeals, of a series of departments of courts of appeals, and completely, as a practical matter, strip the state Supreme Court of its responsibility of original jurisdiction in any categories of cases. Well, I think that's going way too far, at least way too far, where we haven't really had the kind of study and input by lawyers and judges, that where we really haven't had the kind of input by lawyers and judges that usually precede an important and radical change in the method of handling our judiciary. This proposal here, which Herb has approved of, is a compromise. It's going too far for some, maybe not far enough for others. But it does clearly say that the court may assign certain categories of jurisdiction to the Court of Appeals. It doesn't speak to how many judges or anything else. That'll be up to Ways and Means. 2 years from now, we can look at what's happened and see if it's working out well, are working out badly, and then if at that point in time, 2 years from now, hopefully there will be a lot, will have been a lot more thought between now and 1979. The judges, the lawyers who are interested in this sort of thing, consumer groups and others who are interested in this whole question will have had an opportunity to give it serious thought, which I don't think they've given it up to now. So for that reason, it seems to me that a fair, present, compromise position, which won't disturb things too badly, no matter, is the proposal that has been approved by Herb Hardy, and that's why I think we ought to adopt it.
Further discussion? Senator Smith.
Well, Madam Chairman, the historical precedence for this radical action is the United States Supreme Court, and that ought to be historical enough for anyone. The point is that if we're going to make a decision as to how the Court of Appeals shall operate on the Supreme Court, and Ways and Means has to make a decision as to how many judges to add, then we must have some control over where appeals are going to go. I can say this because I don't have to be held accountable for it. Those who oppose this radical action, I think, are those who oppose personalities between the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. And it's a personality problem we have, not one of procedure, in my opinion. I don't think it's very radical, and I think that we ought to be able to gather ourselves up and make a decision that the Court of Appeals ought to operate as the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court ought to operate on the writ of certiorari. That's a tough word for me. So, if we are going to continue the Supreme Court as it is under its workload, we're going to have to provide two pro tems. If we're going to continue the Court of Appeals, we must provide two more judges. It seems the natural delineation of things to move the appeals down to the Court of Appeals, add four judges, take the lone judges from the Supreme Court until the workload develops, and handle it clearly, definitively, and so everyone knows by the lead time where their cases are going to go. They don't have to check the latest discussion between the two courts and the bar as to whether they should appeal to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. It seems very simple. So I would oppose the motion, Madam Chairman, and support Senator Ford's motion.
Ken?
I feel like I haven't done my homework outside of these meetings, but I hope you'll bear with me trying to learn while I'm here. Could someone tell me how the Supreme Court would feel comfortable with going from 43 cases that they handled last year on certiorari and 265 from other things to having the rest of their workload, which that's 5/6 of their workload or something like that, be pinch hitting with the Court of Appeals?
Well, this part is of the answer, I suppose, would be that if they had more manpower, they'd take more petitions for writs of certiorari.
You have to plug into that the arithmetic of the Court of Appeals, considering all of the cases first and how many writs there would be filed with the Supreme Court as a result of the appellate court hearing all of the cases that the Supreme Court is now hearing, but to whom there is no further appeal.
So we'd probably end up with the Supreme Court hearing a lot more writs. Granting a lot more writs.
And then probably granting.
Further discussion.
Just to close before the motion, everyone else has talked. It seems to me that the ultimate, the most desirable state of affairs, which is not possible, would be to have every appealed case decided by the Supreme Court. That we have accepted because of the great volume in this state is no longer possible. And when we adopted the Court of Appeals statute, I'm sure we adopted it not because we thought it was improving the quality of the appellate decision or necessarily reducing it, but because as a practical matter we had this great volume of cases that had to be handled, which couldn't be adequately and properly handled by the Supreme Court. So we decided that they need help at the appellate level, and so we established the Court of Appeals. The policy that was established then, which kind of perhaps balanced, on the one hand, with the establishment of the Court of Appeals, we lost the ideal situation where you have the last word in what the law is. On the other hand, we permitted a type of specialization that probably wasn't really, perhaps not possible on the Supreme Court, by being able to set up and say that the Court of Appeals will be the specialists in criminal law, municipal law, workman's comp. So we got a plus. We lost the last word, but we did get a plus that we created a group of specialists. Now what I'm saying here is, in terms of the merits of the situation without regards to whether it should be studied longer, which I think it should be, whether or not the bar approves of it, which I think it should, but the merits of the situation are that by adopting this amendment, we would preserve as much of what most people, lawyers or not, would consider to be the ideal situation. That is, that the court that decides it is the one that has the last word, rather than creating a situation where there has to be it's a gamble whether or not you will ever have the last word on your case. You may be hung and the next guy is freed. Law exactly the same. Only one the court allowed certiorari and the other one they didn't. So, to illustrate. So what I'm saying is this is a fair compromise now at this point in time. And what about, how are they going to man or woman it? Well, it would seem to me they could do it either way. You could either appoint the four Court of Appeals judges, which probably wouldn't be the wisest course of action to follow with this interim proposal. But what could be done that would not emblazon this in stone would be to adopt this compromise, to approve of, and then Ways and Means could approve of the two Court of Appeals judges, because most people seem to agree we need two more for one reason or another, and then to fund two pro tem judges. Now what's so bad about pro tem judges? They're just voted out of this committee, a proposed Missouri plan, where they're not elected. It surely can't be then because these pro tems weren't elected to be Supreme Court justices. That argument has fallen by the wayside, I would think. Presumably the Supreme Court justices are going to pick the highest quality circuit court judges they could find. And they're probably going to be the kinds of persons they would put on that list if the Missouri plan were adopted. So chances are those two pro tem judges serving, maybe not all for this two-year term, are going to be of a quality as high or higher than the Court of Appeals judges who would be appointed on a permanent basis. So what I'm saying is we can have the best of both worlds. We can take the conservative approach. We can retain as much original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court as they can handle. We can give them the authority to designate by category subgroups to go to the Court of Appeals where the special knowledge can be made to play and operate.
But nobody believed it. Smith the liberal and Cook the conservative.
That's always the way it is.
The amendment is the markup. The clerk will call the roll on the amendment.
Cook?
Aye.
Gabori?
No.
Smith?
No.
Wires?
Aye.
Betty Roberts?
No.
Madam Chairman?
No. The motion fails.
May I explain my vote? Main motion may be the right way to go. I'm in an embarrassing position of having to say I don't feel I really fully grasp this issue.
Burns' motion was one that would give more time. It's awfully embarrassing to say that I don't grasp this whole issue.
Madam Chairman, speaking further, the motion which is to send it out, I'd ask you, Jan, to vote with me against sending it out until they get their five votes. And then if they get their five votes, then you and I will sign a minority report.
I'll go get the fifth vote.
Then you and I will sign a minority report.
Well,
because I think
how did I get caught in the middle of this? This is the two most powerful institutions, perhaps, in the state of Oregon. And what we're apparently getting ready to do is to vote to. Now, when this first came up, things just really accelerated because Justice Schwab and Justice Denneke came in and said, now, we thought we were going to go for this study and we could get this all worked out. And then things started happening fast in the House, and now maybe we won't need the study. And now we've got the bar here saying they want a study and they want more time.
Madam Chairman,
young guy like me get caught between these two? I mean,
my turn. You talk twice. If we were to accept Vern Cook's proposal, which we have already turned down, we have an anomalous situation where, depending on the subject matter, you might have two reviews or one review. If your case happened to fall in the category where it went to the Supreme Court, they'd take original jurisdiction, that'd be it, one court. But if your case just happened to fit into another category that went to the Court of Appeals, then you could always appeal that decision to the Supreme Court. So you got some, for no real good reason, you'd have some groups of cases would be subject to only one appeal, and other ones would be subject to two appeals. That doesn't make sense to me. I think what Senator Smith and I have worked out, like the Hansel Wilner plan.
I thought you were going to say Hansel and Gretel.
My motion, Senator Smith's idea, it makes sense to me because all the cases are going to be treated alike, regardless of subject matter. And that makes logical, rational sense to me. It's a place we're going to go to anyway. I think the legislature ought to make a decision and do it.
And I'd like to add this, that I think that where we are is a crucial point that legislatures and legislators face, and that is whether or not to make a very important decision before you have a substantial body of facts or expertise before you upon which to base that decision. In my opinion, because of the fast way this came up, that this committee, nor the House committee, has not had before it either a factual or an intellectual justification of this move at this time in this state. And I think that if we take this action, it'll be one of the, not that it won't be typical, but it'll be one of the least thoughtful actions that this committee or this legislature will have taken. Just a bad decision because we haven't given to it the kind of investigation into the merits, and we haven't given to it the kind of investigation into finding out the attitudes of those who are most involved in this particular kind of practice.
Madam Chairman, I think, and I agree with the Senator, that quality is important, is an important commodity in these weighty decisions made by the court. If you want quality, you're going to support this bill because this would provide the time that the Supreme Court can sit and review and write, interpret, and sometimes make law, give them the time that they don't have now, they haven't had. With the two pro tems assigned them, they're not going to have. We are going to improve the quality of law in this state, and I am all in favor of that.
Madam Chairman. How did this happen? I know I said, I want to say it again. We're waiting for Wally anyway. The legal institution, my worm's eye view, have been things that happen gradually.
Jan, if I can answer your question.
And here we've got Mr. Hardy here being asked to respond to things. I can't imagine a stately gentleman like him being asked to talk about something that's caught him unawares. And that in itself really bothers me. I mean,
you know, this is
I've been the guy all my life said, come on, let's hurry up, Keith. Well, you're here too.
I'm
in
the big committee, excuse me.
We're glad to have you.
The motion
they used
before
to do this to me last session, only they called fatally out of ways. Now you understand.
State law doesn't have to go.
The motion before us is the due pass on me and Gross House Bill 3172.
Madam Chairman, may I restate my, I'd like to, now that we have eight of us here, which is our full complement, I'd like, and I know the result will probably be the same, but I think the way to do it would be, I would like to again, if I may, move the amendment, and then in supporting that amendment, urge my point of view to the two members who are here.
No, you've tried your amendment.
All right, then I'll speak then in opposition to the passing out of the bill, but I want to point to Senator Brown and Senator Carson that we have before us a proposed amendment which failed by a vote of 2-4 a while ago. And that proposed amendment, which you have in your packet, was prepared by our committee counsel in consultation with Herb Hardy, who is representing the Oregon State Bar. And this was in response to what amounted to a demand upon him to prepare something or be stuck with what the Dean Gross bill was.
Well, let me just add, he didn't prepare it. It was prepared at my request by Diana, and he gave his approval, which came from the bar.
All right. Now, that proposal is a compromise, in my opinion, is a compromise position between the original legislation, which was before this legislature, which would have, on the one hand, called for a study to decide what should be done at the appellate level, and on the other hand, would have increased the number of Court of Appeals judges by 2 and would have authorized 2 pro tem Supreme Court judges for the next 2 years. Now, after the passage of the amendment, which you now see engrossed in House Bill 3172, the engrossed version, was adopted, we have obtained a response from the members of the Oregon State Bar through their counsel and through their board. And I think we can say or believe that the amendment would be acceptable to them because it does not flat out create the three-level system in Oregon for all cases, but would simply give to the Supreme Court the same authority that the bill as it came from the House would have given to the Supreme Court. The authority to transfer cases over to the Court of Appeals, but would do so with this restriction that it would have to be done by categories. And so my argument in support of this amendment, which would be my argument in opposition to a vote to send this bill to the floor in its present form, would be, number one, the Oregon State Bar and its members who are interested in things like this have not had the opportunity to carefully look at and understand the bill in the form that it's in now. Secondly, they are opposed to the bill in the form that it is now. I think that we should give some recognition to that opposition. After all, they are the people who are working with this law more than anyone else. Thirdly, this compromise would retain, would not do away for all time, the some original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court, and would only require the delegation of original jurisdiction in appellate matters to the Court of Appeals that was necessary in order to permit the appellate function to be accomplished. So what I am urging upon the absent members is that you vote No on the motion to send this to the floor, and after that vote, I assume, if there are only four votes in sending it to the floor, then there'd be a good likelihood that a motion to reconsider the vote by which this amendment passed, or a motion to amend it, would have a good chance of passage, and then we could get the bill out to the floor in an amended form.
Further discussion?
Madam Chairman, just a question. The language, those appeals, which Byrne would want to take out, and which is in the bill at the present time, is that my understanding?
No, you see, they've changed it completely.
Changes jurisdiction to all appeals.
I've got A gross here, I'm sorry.
You want B engrossed. It's an amendment.
This is the bar amendment. Okay, that's all right.
We'll call it the bar amendment, even though it's the Brown amendment.
No. The bill at the present time says the Supreme Court may transfer to the Court of Appeals.
No, not the bill in the form that's before us, Walt.
No,
that was amended at the last meeting. To transfer all appeals to the Court of Appeals.
We amended this. Further discussion.
Hang on.
Don't feel bad.
I never feel bad.
While he's looking at that, could I ask another question?
You haven't got me engrossed there. Jim?
While he's looking at that, I wanted to ask a question. What is the consumer argument in favor of having this two-tiered system in all cases that B. Engrossed would give us? Senator Cook has raised the argument that it would make people go through more levels of appeal, I think. And I'm wondering what the argument in terms of the consumer is in favor of the two-tier.
It would seem to me that with the situation we have now, in which some cases can be appealed to the Supreme Court, that's the court of last resort. You don't have the opportunity to go through the appellate court and then to have the review by the Supreme Court on those cases that go directly to the Supreme Court. If you're looking at the opportunity to treat everyone equally, as you do those who go through the appellate court now, because that's where they're first appealed, but they can appeal all of those cases to the Supreme Court, they have another shot. And I think that the argument that Senator Cook gives is self-defeating when he says that it's not for the consumer because they have to go to another step. If they want to go all the way, it's just the opposite. It treats everyone alike. All of the appeals go to the appellate court. Everyone has the opportunity to then perfect that appeal to the Supreme Court if they choose. Now, those that go to the Supreme Court have no other place to go. That's it.
May I respond to the consumer argument?
All right.
Now,
three times.
I know. Maybe you want to speak four or five more times. But first of all, on quality, and I have to make it very clear that by definition, and not my personal preference, by definition, Supreme Court decision has a higher quality than the Court of Appeals.
By definition.
Obviously. Yeah, because otherwise, why would you appeal from one to the other? I mean, there is a highest court and there's a lower court, and there's a middle court. What I'm saying is, I'm assuming that in terms of quality, by definition, the quality of justice is the best. If you wanted a lawyer, you'd want the best, okay? If you wanted the highest court of the city, you're trying to decide on a case, do you have a court of appeals decision or do you have a Supreme Court decision? Which one would you give the greatest weight to? I know the Supreme Court decision, because that's the highest court.
By my silence, I don't want to acquiesce in that.
All right, but anyway. Now, I have to make this
qualification. Which ones I agree on.
I have to make this qualification. I have to make this qualification in order to avoid insulting Court of Appeals judges. All right, now.
Well, in bonk is what you mean.
In bonk. Now, quality. What does the consumer want? The consumer wants the best there is.
The consumer,
if it's
want
possible.
Any,
well, but if he has to, if you're forced to be operated on by a doctor, you want the best doctor in the world, not the lousiest one or the intern. Right? Okay. The consumer wants the best quality merchandise he can get. the best quality merchandise on an appeal level is the highest court that has the last word, that establishes the law that's not likely to be changed without a couple of deaths. Okay. Now, that happens.
Is that
that happens to be a different quality than equal opportunity. Now, if you say, is it wrong that someone gets a high quality of justice just because everyone else gets an inferior quality of justice? Does that make it wrong? I don't think so. I say it's too bad they all can't get the highest quality of justice, but we've already agreed they can't because of the great volume of business. And so we're saying, if you can't give them a steak, it's better to give them a hamburger than give them nothing. I've used that argument before in other contexts. We're saying here, just because you can't give everyone a T-bone steak doesn't mean you have to feed everybody on hamburger.
So long as it's meat.
All right. Now, there are, on the other hand, there is in our present system something that is good. It's not all hamburger in the Court of Appeals, because we are getting a certain degree of expertise, because the Supreme Court is only assigning certain kinds of cases to the Court of Appeals. And so it may well be that the Court of Appeals judges now are more expert in criminal law and workman's comp law as a body than the Supreme Court. That's our present system. And that's the system that I'm suggesting we continue, and that we should retain as much of the appellate jurisdiction as possible in the Supreme Court, as long as they're capable of handling it. But this amendment would give to them the authority to assign out, by category, as much of what they would have to kind of define as maybe less important functions that they have to the Court of Appeals, so they can keep current. I'm just saying we can have our cake and eat it too with this amendment. And this is the best of the two worlds for now.
Ben,
and if 2 years from now we change our mind, we can change it again.
Benny has another amendment. To meet your problem, Vern, we could propose to eliminate the Court of Appeals totally, move all those judges to the Supreme Court, and everybody gets to go to that great court in the sky, the final decision maker.
I thought you were going to say the judicial conference.
And that would be true consumer protection.
I'm the biggest question.
Question's been called for. Is there any objection?
Clerk, call the roll.
Rhonda Brown.
Passing out.
Pass out
B engrossed.
It's not my amendment, because she wouldn't let me make it. But if you vote no on this, then I make the amendment as soon as the motion fails.
Vern, I was with
the
you
question on the question is, before us, is
being
gross, House Bill 3172, do pass as amended. Clerk will call the roll.
Walter Brown.
Aye. I'm sorry.
Carson?
No.
Cook?
No.
Kafori?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Wires?
No.
Roberts?
Aye.
Betty Brown?
Aye. Motion passes.
I would like to file a minority report, Madam Chair.
54. All right.
And
someone join you? Yeah,
okay. All you'll join me, and Diane, will you prepare it in the form?
One question. The whole purpose of 3172 was to send Ways and Means a message. Did this have a subsequent referral of Ways and Means?
No.
They'll get the message and pass it.
Oh, message. Now, let's see if we can agree what the message is. Okay.
The message doesn't really mean anything. They're
going to do what they want to do anyway.
If I just remember my quote from Hamlet, I'd like to explain my vote. Something about hardly had the funeral cakes cooled when they were issued forth in the bridal celebration.
I'd like to announce to the audience that we are not going to get to House Bills 2258, 2259,
and 2257 today. SDR 54,
let's see, Ed Sullivan was here.
Say other
Herb here.
Yeah.
Were you joining on the minority?
I wasn't invited, so I guess my vote is...
Well, you're joining.
Yes. To join with us.
Join with us.
I'm hurt now. You just...
Oh, for Christ. He has seniority, that's all.
SJR 54.
I'm easy.
It's always the Cook Carson Coalition.
That's right.
Or Carson Cook Coalition.
I'm going to take it away until our report.
What are we going through now?
SJR 54.
I don't propose the amendment.
Well,
you haven't found it. You're amending it. Oh, Christmas.
This way is a bank.
I don't know whether I'm going to join.
Yeah,
order.
Just let me know.
I'll let you know.
This book is hard to figure.
It's just before the last orange line. Or the big orange.
This is
Wally.
Wally.
Well, Fred Hurd wanted to appear on this, and he was here with Ed Sullivan. Do you want to make your amendment or wait until they come back?
Oh, are they going to be back today? That will give me some time to work out what exactly the language I want.
All right. Then let's go to the victims. Diana, is there a mock-up?
Yes, there is, Madam Chair. I might add that it will probably take at least 15 minutes to go through this. Did we want to start it now? We can.
Well, yes, of course. Okay.
Sure.
You should see in your folder some long Xerox mock-up of Senate Bill 507.
Look at what, huh?
So what did we move to?
Oh, we're on SJR 54.
We left 54?
Yeah, Fred Hurd and Ed Sullivan wanted to appear on it.
Oh, so until they come back, we're...
Yeah.
Did we lose Vern now?
I don't know.
So what are we going back to?
He's going to write his minority report.
Going to
send
in your folder, you'll see
a
mock-up.
And that's all we need is the mock-up.
Unless you want to look at your original copy of 507 to make it clear where the changes occurred.
Let's go ahead and go through it then.
All right.
Can I interrupt, Madam Chairman?
Sure.
Do you want us to wait till she goes through it, or can we just shot
at
it?
No, tackle right at it
okay.
If you want.
2 weeks ago, this committee met and made a number of decisions on what should be or should not be incorporated in a bill, and I have done a mock-up incorporating those decisions. Page 2 of the bill, the only change there is on line 9, where I changed the word workman's compensation board to workers' compensation board to conform with what...
Let's go ahead.
Madam Chairman, right on that point, the policy decision has been made... that it would be in workers' comp. For the record, I'd just like to state I'd prefer a different, a separate body, but I take it that the majority, substantial majority, prefers workers' comp.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Page 2, line
9. Do you want to take up 54 now?
Yeah.
Senator Corey, you wanted to make an amendment?
I want to make an amendment. I don't know exactly. I'd like to have Diana put it in words, so I just scratched down some ideas here. To say that the study shall include but not be limited to the causes of juvenile delinquency and the handling by the juvenile court of non-delinquent youth, as well as the problems in juvenile corrections.
You have a comment on that, Frank?
Yeah, Madam Chairman, if I could say a couple of words. As you and I were served on the corrections task force, I think we had met about a day, and it was obvious that we wanted to go leaping into juvenile correction, and we reached the conclusion.
Could I, Fred, what's your definition of juvenile correction? Because most of the juvenile work is contrary to what I know to be correction. So could you kind of...
Okay, I would say any kind of a holding facility where you have to actually take a youngster and confine them in some kind of an institutional setting. As we started looking at adult corrections and the governor's charge and so on with overcrowded conditions and so on, and then as I went to Minnesota and found some 16-year-olds in the adult corrections facilities back there, there was a feeling that, gee, there's a crisis here, but since the charge had already gone toward the adults and the overcrowding, we just felt that we had to put that off and that would be 2 years of work in itself. But I'd say confinement, where a juvenile is taken out of home and placed in some kind of other setting.
Would you object if we thought of it as, I haven't given a lot of thought, but I'd like to see it a little broader, more like corrections is in adult capacity, which would include all forms of alternatives in addition to confinement. In other words, a parallel to parole, a parallel to probation, suspension, all of which are
youth care centers.
Correct.
I'd say on corrections facilities is rather tight, and certainly if we go to the community corrections concept this session, I think we will, it would be completely inconsistent not to look at the whole thing as far as juvenile problems are concerned.
Madam Chairman, the reason I say that, Fred, is I'd like to see the study, but I'd like to see them, they may conclude, much as others have concluded, that the corrections facilities are not necessarily the way we ought to go in dealing with juveniles.
Yeah.
They might conclude that youth care centers or a foster care program or something is better than bricks and mortar, and I'd like to give the task force the same latitude, if that's their search, to come up with that, as to assume that they're just going to talk about sight and sound requirements and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's fine, Molly. I can't say, as I look back on the governor's task force on corrections for adults, we knew that his position was that he didn't want to build a new prison. We thought that most of our positions were along that line. But I can't say we were really locked in. If we had come around to the conclusion, well, that might have been our recommendation. But then as we started doing the investigation and so on, this developed. So we were pretty free, even though there was a charge there to do what we wanted to do and go where the information led us, and that's why we came up with the idea.
Okay.
So, yes, it should be quite open. We know from our work on the adult task force that there's a great deal of work to be done. I think it's a very urgent measure, and it's really much more important than five lines.
Thank you.
The amendment was to include causes of juvenile delinquency, state offenses, all kinds of facilities.
Yeah, I mean, in the narrow sense of causes, I don't mean let's talk about racism and let's talk about unemployment, but the direct type causes and the handling of kids who are not juvenile delinquents. A kid who's taken away from his parents and put in charge of CSD, and from the foster home, isn't really juvenile corrections. But if we find that 90% of those kids go on to be burglars, then that ought to be part of the study. And that's why I'm concerned that the study be...
Is there any objection to the amendment? Amendments adopted then? Anything further you want to say?
Well, what I was going to say along Steve's, along the line Steve's talking about, we're doing some rather fantastic work, I think, this time in alcohol and drug problems as they relate to those in adult corrections. We started in that direction last time. We recognized some problem areas and some things that we want to change. But that's kind of what we did with the adults. We looked at those maybe who are marginal, who really haven't taken the great leap yet, who maybe got into crime, you know, when they were drinking, and were okay the rest of the time. We've kind of looked at the whole thing, so I think that would be completely consistent.
Is there a motion on the bill? Do pass as amended. Discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Parsons?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Kapori?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Wires?
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
All right. Thank you very
thank
much.
You, thank
I'm
you.
Sorry you had to wait so long. Back to victims. It's a mock-up. You don't need your book. Page 3, Diana.
Page 3, the committee made the decision to list crimes, but leave some discretion in the board to include others that just inadvertently or just may not have been considered in this list, and that's why I amended line 1 the way I did.
Mm-hmm.
Betty. Diana, just a drafting thing. I think it's usually said included but not limited to. It cuts down on your words.
Which day are you talking?
The mock-up that's in your folder. Wally?
Yes, thank you.
Or includes but not limited to.
That's a substantial amendment. What's the mechanism?
There's a minimum in here. What is the minimum, Diana?
I'm sorry, the minimum?
What I'm worried about is when you say include but not limited to, then it's all crimes compensable, crimes of violence. Now, how do you determine whether you've made a crime of, you may have answered that, but there are crimes of violence and there are crimes committed with violence, and there are crimes of violence, there is no violence.
Unless there is a personal injury to somebody.
Well, are we voting for every crime where there is an injury?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Is it
I
limited to
No, but
well,
we
include
we
but not limited to means that we're including every crime of violence.
But then we specifically do limit it in subsection 3 on that page, line 15, to not include crimes where crimes committed during the course of the operation of a motor vehicle, boat, or aircraft, unless that was used as a weapon.
I know, but this is a substantial change, and it includes every crime. As I read it, the words included but not limited to, or include but are not limited to.
I think Diana's drafting was right.
Either way, means that all crimes of violence are compensable unless there is a specific prohibition. And then it probably ought to refer to Section 3 as, except as provided in Section 3, all crimes of violence. What I'm saying is that the language was originally designed to be limiting. The words include but not limited to open it wide open. So then I argue that it really we ought to say, if that's what we intend, all crimes of violence. And then I wonder what we mean by crimes of violence. I guess we do have a definition of that, don't we?
No,
that's circulatory. That means crimes of violence mean those crimes enumerated in Section 2.
When we ran around that tree, and as I remember, we had some discussion about whether we should enumerate them or not, or just say crimes of violence. And as I remember the discussion, it was that we aren't trying to limit it, but let's list them. So that looks to me like what Diana has done here. So I guess if you feel that there's something that ought to be excluded, I'd like to hear what.
Well, I could say this, after 6 years on the criminal law revision, I'm very reluctant to pick up a new phrase called crimes of violence, which has no definition now, and say that we're going to compensate people for crimes of violence, whatever they may be, and then just wash our hands and walk away from it. To answer your question, I'd have to know what crimes of violence are in order to say what items I think really aren't crimes of violence.
Track the words including but not limited to, so we have.
Well, I apologize to the committee and to the chair and to the council for not being here when you hashed this all out. That's probably not fair for me to do it, but to make this concern known. We've said nothing really. It's worth nothing. I think we've said all crimes of violence. If that's what we mean.
Betty,
what
we're trying to get at, I think, are crimes in which there's a personal injury result, with the exception of those that are excluded in subsection 3. And so, because that's all we're going to compensate anyone for.
Well, okay, but
we're going to compensate them for property damage or anything of that sort.
But historically, I would argue that crimes of violence is a philosophical word almost. It defines the actor's intent or action and not the result. In other words, a crime of attempted assault would be a crime of violence, even though he never completed the violence and there was no injury, I would argue.
Okay, then could I make a proposal? Two proposals. One is that we define crime for the purposes of this act means and leave out a violence. then also include enumerated section 2 of this act and some way work in a crime that causes bodily injury.
Okay. I think this group ought to know that I'm very conservative in this area because I'd like to have it start slow and build rather than grab off too much and have the first 2 years marred by fraud and fraudulent claims and crummy attempts to gain compensation and then have the public lose faith in our ability to meet this, which we all agree, I think, is a need.
Well, we're not encouraging that, though. We have a limit. And then somebody has some other crime in which they get injured in, some funny misdemeanor like shooting arrows at railroad trains or something, and they apply for compensation. They find out the only way they can do that is to construe it around to make it be negligently wounded or something, which doesn't perhaps fit exactly in that category. Are we encouraging fraud by defining it too narrowly?
Well, I would think not. If we define it, if we stay with it in this manner, I don't think we run that risk. If we turn it around and say, Senator Roberts indicated it one way out, and say a personal injury result, then I think no matter what we do, if we move in that direction, we run that risk of having somebody come up with a bad back after a holdup. And, you know, then I, of course, workman's comp is used to dealing with that.
Well, you have to prove it's related to the crime.
Well,
but the crime caused the injury.
Okay,
there's a minimum of $250.
Madam Chairman, I think we're going too broad on this bill the way it's involved. You've got a lot of negligent acts here that should be covered by, frequently will be covered by liability insurance. And I don't know how you handle that in here.
You've got that taken
care of. If
they
can't
work twice.
You guys were
well,
here last time. Work it all out. I'll come back
well,
next
the point
time.
Is,
sorry.
Here's
no offense intended.
No offense, Sam, but I apologize anyway. I'm sorry.
I could support something limited to intentional crimes, but with all the negligence we've got in here, there's the question of just. I think we're going too far here, and I agree. I think I agree with Wally. I don't know if that's your reservation, but I was just looking through this list here, trying to check the statutes. Under B, manslaughter, 163.118, sub A is negligence. That involves negligence, not intentional. Under 163.125, again, that's negligence. A is negligence. The rest of it is intentional. Under C here, criminally negligent homicide, again, that's negligence. And down in K here, negligently wounding another. Well, there you're talking about shooting a gun or a bow and arrow or something. And I just think that for two reasons, one of which I think is more logical than the other, I think if we go into the program, it should be limited to intentional crime.
Yeah.
And secondarily, there isn't going to be, well, there are rare cases where insurance companies insure against intentional crimes, like with all the Brown amendments, parents are going to be insured against their kids' intentional crimes, you know, under that special section, and that's covered under the homeowners, and their St. Paul Fire and Marine used to write an intentional coverage. I think under my coverage, for example, I've got, if I commit libel under my comp general, I have coverage. But in general, intentional torts are not insurable. And I think that's the kind of category we should be getting at here to cover those kinds of torts that are not usually insurable, for want of a better category. And these things I point out in B and C and K are types of conduct that are insurable.
Betty. I think the point is not whether or not they're insurable. The point is whether or not we want to cover a person who's not going to be able to collect for the damage done to that individual. For example, criminally negligent homicide. That could be the result of a drunken driver who kills the father of three kids and is uninsured. He doesn't have any life insurance. He leaves very little estate. And it would seem to me that what we're doing is attempting to reach some of these
on these situations.
Does the bill, and where is it, provide that where there is insurance in effect that nothing can be collected?
Where is that, Diana? That is a set-off. Anything that's collected from workers' comp, social security, insurance, all sorts of things is a set-off. Where is it?
I'm sorry, that's page 5, lines 30 through 34. Particularly from funds from any other source on line 32.
All right, now we want to make doggone sure, though, in here, if you're going to have it, you make it unlawful for any insurance company to write an exclusion in their policy that requires a person to go against this fund first.
Is there subrogation in here, Diana?
Subrogation by the insurance company? No.
No, by the state.
Yes, the state would be subrogated to any claim which the victim might have against the offender.
Where's that?
That is in
is that failure to urinary tract
infection?
Yeah, well, clearly. I'd say that. Now the question is whether it also constitutes intent murder for the same speech that it fired at the police.
That's page 10, Madam Chairman, section 20, lines 24 through 34. Or actually, lines 24 through 26. The state has a claim for the amount of compensation.
Okay, Len?
Well, I think I would prefer to, I'd like to have I think we want to make sure that the insurance company doesn't require the person to go against this fund.
You want to amend it so the insurance company can't put an exclusion in their policy?
Right.
Well, that'd be just an addition or something.
Yeah.
That would be my suggestion.
Have we come to an inclusion on section 2 yet?
No. Is there any objection to Vern's amendment? Hearing none, it passes. Have you got a suggested amendment on two?
If it makes Wally happy, I'd be happy to agree to his amendment to drop out the included but not limited to, and just say these are the crimes right here.
Ready?
Well, that's fine if that's what it's going to take to get the bill out. Wally, the concern is this, that in most of the bills before, they have been listed. The question is, will a case arise where we fail to identify a crime?
I'm sure that's true.
And if some way we could add a, we could let the board decide that's going to be reviewing these cases, whether or not that crime falls within the intent of the fact. Now, I don't know how that can be said, but that's why I said an act that resulted in a personal injury.
I would reach out to that, but I think that has more problems than where we are now. I'd be more content to stay with crimes of violence and then wrestle with what we mean by violence than try to deal with the outcome.
Well, but you're going to have crimes of violence and then these listed as only those.
Well, that would be one way to get the problem, and I have problems with paragraph 2 under that too. So I don't want to hold this bill as hostage, but I think it's important that we pass something, and I perhaps I'm overly conservative, but I think whatever we pass ought to work. I think.
Well, then let's amend it the way you want it, and just leave the list. And
right, the amendment is strike included, but are not limited to. Is there a discussion? Is there any objection? The motion passes, then.
Madam Chairman.
Vern.
Another, I don't know if this is covered in here or not, but another concern that I would have if I were administering this fund would be that this might look like the easiest way to go under some. You'd have a person that would have two alternative ways to go. They could go against the fund, or they might go against the negligent third party. And I wonder if there shouldn't be some way where they could, or...
We're taking care of that, Bert.
What is that?
End of the bill.
Required to be
Kate,
joined?
Did you want to say anything on this bill?
No, I really have nothing great help to the committee. I think it would be help if, of help to the board if we are only giving this program to have as clear a definition of what is compensable as is possible, realizing as a lawyer that this is difficult sometimes to define. But I really don't. I have a great deal to offer.
Question, Manager.
Senator Smith.
I'm bothered, Keith, and I always have been, about this bill because, I like the concept and the idea, but I would prefer to have the most heinous situation you could think of paid for if we had the money and drop out the lower kinds of abuses. And I'm trying to, in my mind, determine how the Ways and Means Committee is going to appropriate X amount of dollars to you. You're going to sit there with this list, and in 6 months you're out of money and you paid off everybody. Or do you prioritize the list, say, okay, everybody gets 50 cents on the dollar because the money doesn't spread? Or how do you do that? I don't understand how you're going to do it. Do you?
I think you just have to, as I read the proposals in the current session, I think the board would be required to make judgments until the fund, and make awards until the fund was exhausted. Come back to the commission board.
I think so too. Then would it be of any help for us to try to attempt to prioritize?
Certainly would be as a bureaucrat, where I sit.
Well, and I think it might be a good idea to do it. I don't know how you prioritize, sodomy against rape or burglary,
I'm not sure
I want to do that.
Well, we're concerned about the serious crime, which probably will cost the most money.
Yes.
But we're also concerned about the little old lady who gets knocked down and she's got $50 in her purse and it's snatched, but she's got $200 or $300 in doctor bills, aren't we?
Yes.
And because she's on Social Security and she probably has Medicare and that sort of thing is going to take care of it, but she may not. And so if you start saying we want to take the big crimes, we're more likely to run out of money faster than if we say we're going to take the crimes regardless of the cost of the crime, because a crime's a crime and this person has been injured and has suffered that problem.
On the other hand, the insurance company experiences to the contrary. And if the insurance companies were writing this program, they'd have a $500 deductible.
Is it $250?
$250. That would not be $250. Well, I just haven't thought it through a little bit. It seems to me that we ought to somehow narrow up the provisions and fund them properly of this bill, and then expand the provisions as the money comes and is available to expand it. I don't know how you do that, but it just seems to me that we ought to be able to fund something that we can identify and make the bill workable.
We're not going to do it until we get some experience.
Yeah, I know.
If you prioritize, and the first cases that come before Keith and that, and there's a big award, and then there's a little award, and then there's a medium-sized award, is he going to have to hold the medium-sized and the little one? Because it doesn't have top priority waiting for a murder case to come before it. So the priority is the order in which they come before the board to make a determination.
Madam Chairman?
Vernon.
In line with this going slowly, my view is we ought to limit it to clearly intentional crimes and eliminate the negligent mm-hmm. categories, even though they are grossly negligent. Because these are, with rare exceptions, the kinds of crimes for which there is no other remedy. And I think it would have, and there's no way to protect yourself against it. I mean, for example, I can protect myself, if I choose to, against uninsured motorists up to 15 and 30,000, whether they're drunk or what. I can protect myself Let's see, well, in the motorist field, I can protect myself.
Anything on this list that isn't intentional?
Oh, it's
negligently wounding, criminal negligence, homicide.
There's four of the categories, there's negligence.
But they're all crimes.
Well, but so is VBR. Well, it used to be a crime. And so it was made a civil infraction.
Manslaughter isn't intentional.
No, it's not intentional.
There are parts here that I was pointing out earlier, Bob, wherever it is.
Page 2,
under 163.118, which is in B, sub A is negligent. 163.125 sub A is negligent. And then C is criminally negligent, just by definition. And K is criminally negligent. And those are all involved negligence rather than intentional crime.
Are you moving intentional crime?
I would move that we delete the negligent portions of the prescribed crime.
What does that do? Does anyone have any idea?
Well, man, there's two points, and I made one point, Bob, while you're out of the room, but there's another one to be made. And that was that a negligent act is a crime sometimes, and a person is injured. And if it's a crime and a person is injured, and that person should be compensated, whether it was intentional or negligent, there still is the result of the personal injury and the harm. Okay, so that's argument number one. Second one is that if crime carries with it intent, the prosecutor has to not only prove the crime was committed, but that there was the intent to commit the crime. If they get the evidence to prove the crime, but they don't get the evidence to prove the formation of the intent, they may very well plea bargain that thing down to a point where they can get a prosecution, and it falls into one of these other categories, and this poor person is there with all the hospital and doctor bills and injured, and because we've amended it out of the bill, just because the DA can't get a prosecution on intent, this person doesn't get compensated.
We don't require conviction for compensation, do we? In this, we don't require that anybody be convicted.
No, but if you are requiring intent, you're going to require that they be
convicted. You're going to have to show the prosecution.
You're going to have a prosecution to prove it.
Well, it'd be a question of fact, but as long as you don't require conviction, that's always going to be an issue, or frequently going to be an issue, whether it was intentional or negligent. Especially when a little old lady gets run over by a truck and drives away. How do you know whether he intentionally drove over or?
But if the charge is reduced, if the charge is reduced to something that the DA knows they can get a conviction on, then it also prevents that person from making a claim under the bill.
No, I wouldn't think so, because that person is not a party to that criminal prosecution.
I had a comment on the negligent versus intentional crimes. All these crimes that are listed, the manslaughter or the negligently wounded, are what you could consider general intent crimes, that the person generally intended the action which he took. He intended to shoot that bow and arrow, or intended to put into motion the forces which resulted in the injury to the person, although he may not have had this specific intent to cause harm, that specific harm to that specific person. As long as he generally intended his action, it can be a crime. And if you want to, I guess I'm trying to clarify.
He got bombed. He went in the tavern. He got drunk. He went out. Intentional as can be, and got in that car and got on the highway. Now, he didn't fully intend
it. Does anyone know how much is in the governor's budget for this program?
Nothing.
There's
discussion going on as to what kind of money will be put in, and frankly, Bob, I think it's just a matter of some evaluation based upon the information that we have in this material that's out here. This thing has a cost projection in it of... Paul, what is it?
Well, I've got the figures on our bill. I don't have yours.
I believe the governor did put his own bill in over on the House side. So the governor's office is
responsible. Both the governor and President Beau have come out and said they will somehow find finances for a plan. So.
You know,
wrong
ways
and means. Yeah. Well, that's true, too.
Madam Chairman, just
go ahead.
Bob, on the basis here, first 18 months, the would be a number of claims estimated of 286. Cost per claim would be approximately $1,900. This is based on a whole bunch of other states' figures, I understand, a kind of a compilation. And that would be then for the first 18 months, $543,000. So we're looking at $500,000 for cost of claims for 18 months.
What basis on this?
On the basis of, yes.
Before amendment, probably.
Sir, I've got a workman's compensation board estimate. Additional claim benefits awards was $578,000 during the 77-79. And then it goes up to $1,500,000 during the 79-81. So it jumps that much. Don't look at them.
But we'd have some experience in that 2 years and we'd know what to do. So I think we're looking probably around $500,000.
The motion for us is to delete any claims which don't have specific intent. Further discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye. Oh, no, I'm not ready. I'm sorry. I'm out of order. No.
The motion would general intent crimes be covered?
If I intend to shoot you and I hit Harriet, yeah.
Don't hit
me. But if I'm shooting out in the brush at what I thought was a rabbit and I hit you, no.
What about impersonates? That's what I'm concerned about. My district has the highest number of impersonates of any place in the state. What happens is that nobody intends to hurt that old lady. They intend to push her out of the way so they can grab the purse. That's a general intent rather than specific intent.
Yes. Yeah, but the crime would be covered here
by robbery,
and he did intend to commit robbery, and if I understand...
Robbery is only if you have a weapon.
No, I think it's where you use force against...
Physical
force,
I thought.
It's not force. Any number.
Not intentionally inflicted on your body harm.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But it is intentional.
But she wouldn't get paid.
Yeah.
She wouldn't get paid.
That'd be my. That's my point. If you intend to commit a crime, that intend to hurt a person, either physically or by, I suppose, property damage. If you're in the process of robbing a grocery store.
Just as using or threatens the immediate use of physical force is robbery.
Let's call and roll on motion.
W. Brown.
I interpret the motion as limiting the coverage. I would vote no.
Limiting.
You're voting no.
No.
Aye.
Cook.
Aye.
Kafoury.
No.
Smith.
Aye.
Wires. Kelly Roberts.
No.
Madam Chairman.
No. Motion passed. Next place at number two, then.
That was just a phrase that passed. Yeah. And then down, the next phrase down in section three, the setting limit.
We missed section two.
Yeah, could I go back and I suppose the answer is because no conviction is required.
Well, they're not apprehended.
I understand. But, okay, I just want to make a point here that. What I'm trying to
prosecution if they are apprehended.
Well, what I'm suggesting here is under two is that there's assumption the person did in fact commit a crime, but because of incapacity or whatever he wasn't able to stand trial. That's not always true. In other words, that's a threshold question of whether a person is able to stand trial, which I think would be included in here. And if the person was incompetent, couldn't stand trial, then that's one route. It's not only those who are not guilty by reason of disease and defect, but those who are incapable of standing trial. But I suppose that the concept really is shifted to the person who is injured. In a situation that might or likely was a crime, then we don't care what happened to the victim, to the perpetrator, do we? We don't care whether he's convicted. I suppose if he's not convicted for the crime, there wouldn't be any compensation. But if he's not found, or and therefore not convicted, or if he's released or sent to a mental institution because he's unable to stand trial, or because he has a not guilty by reason of disease and defect, in all those cases, the victim would still get compensation. Darn.
Diana,
I might adjust myself that the situation where we're saying that notwithstanding that by reason of age, a crime may not have been committed. The situation where you've got a 15-year-old who commits robbery and injures the individual. Robbery has not been committed because the person is 15. We use the language engages in conduct which, if committed by an adult, would constitute mm-hmm. a felony. Mm-hmm. But it is not, in fact, robbery where it's committed by a 15-year-old. Or some, but what is it, below the age of 12, the law deems a male to be legally incapable of committing the crime of rape. But in fact, a woman may have been raped and may have suffered harm from that. And I think that that was what we were, the committee was trying to get at.
I understand that. I've said my piece on this thing, and I guess if we're comfortable with the idea that we're really focusing on the alleged victim of alleged crime, then what happens to the alleged perpetrator becomes irrelevant. Then this doesn't make any less sense than awarding when no one's ever convicted of the crime.
Well, they are required to help in the prosecution. The person is apprehended and accused of the crime.
Well, I understand. What I'm thinking about is this. Here in Salem, a person is accused of, an elderly person is accused of mugging, purse snatching another elderly person. At the time of trial, it's pleaded that he's incapable of assisting his own defense, so it never comes to trial. That's the end of it. Okay. Under this, if I read this correctly, the victim. Whether or not there's ever been a determination of whether, one, a crime was committed, two, whether the person apprehended committed the crime, the person would be eligible to get compensation. And so what I'm saying is that we've made a policy decision, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but I think it's a very significant policy decision, that it's the victims of alleged crimes that we're assisting, not victims of crimes.
Well, there's also restitution in here.
Well, that's another.
Is there a procedure for establishing the commission of a crime? You'd almost have to establish the commission of a crime before you have any claim.
That's what the Workers' Compensation Board is going to have to do.
Well, how in the world can they do that? If I fall out and break my leg.
And say you were mugged.
And I said, a guy rode by here and tried to hit and run. He's gone.
You've got to report it to the police.
Well,
that's
easy to do.
And he's guilty of a false police report.
I'm going to take care of it. If I know what I'm doing, I'm going to do that. Say, hit and run guy missed me.
Well, of course, we have this sort of thing in the uninsured motorist. I doubt that there's such bad experience. If you have the phantom vehicle, for example, I believe we just changed it. You must have filed a report with the police within 48 hours in the case of a phantom vehicle. It ought to, if it doesn't.
Yeah, there's time for it.
Is there? But there must be a report filed with the police within 48 hours, and unless, I think in that case, unless there is...
Injury prevented or whatever.
Injury prevented or another witness who can corroborate it, as I recall. Now, if you have someone who could corroborate it, then you
72 wouldn't...
72 hours. Now, I don't know, when one might ask the... I doubt that there have been many false claims. One might ask Tom Bessnett, for example, and we could find out what kind of experience have they had under this.
Yeah,
isn't it the same problem they have with workman's comp now? I mean,
aren't they
used to dealing with this, and isn't that a problem for...
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. They have to make determinations like that occasionally.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think it's actually different. I don't say it's impossible.
Well, my associate just represented a client where he claimed that he got hurt in a certain way, and the other said they saw him dancing on top of the car the next day or something.
You're talking about questions. Tax, I think you just pay, they forget about it. They can't even find it.
That's what the rates indicate.
Yeah.
Okay, final pitch on that, I won't prolong it, because I think from what everybody said, that is the area to make points on that one is back on the hurdles that have to be jumped in order to collect rather than here, because I see that problem. But I caution myself that if we make this overbroad and we underfund it, we will be doing the victims of crime a much greater injustice than not doing anything at all, in my judgment, because client security fund is a good example.
Okay, not on the point of funding, but Wally, in the insanity and drunkenness, they're both defenses in certain cases, you know.
Yes.
And so if there is a crime, the criminal gets off on the basis of insanity, that doesn't prevent this person from...
I understand it, but it even goes further. There's no finding of a crime, and that's what we've got to talk about here, because a person from Fairview who's been committed and is incompetent and can't aid in these defenses accused of committing a crime. There never is a determination whether a crime was ever committed because the person can't stand trial.
Yeah, there's another provision. You know the crime was committed.
No, you don't.
You know, the person was injured,
but there's, you know, the normal criminal trial, one of the elements is prove the crime was committed.
They know that the person from Fairview did the act.
No, I'm saying...
The Workers' Compensation Board does, and they're not...
No, I'm saying that they don't know. It's just that he's been accused of doing the act.
Okay, we're not worried about accused. We're accused of... we're concerned about the crime happening.
Well, okay.
And if there is the crime... Regardless of, and you'd never ever comprehend whatever we do, find a lot of the criminals.
Well, I understand that, and that's what...
We never comprehend them either.
I hear you, I understand the choice. I worry about being overbroad at this juncture, but I hear the choice of the committee. I recognize it. I think it is certainly a legitimate way to go. I think the thing we have to do is then make sure that the proof to the Workers' Compensation Board is sufficient, that we... diminish the possibility of fraud. Because we're really focusing on a victim.
Is there a provision in here for action if it's found that after the fact that the person acted fraudulently?
Yeah.
I thought there was. Yeah.
If there is a provision for the state to recoup any monies paid to the victim, there was a policy decision made by the committee at the last work session that we would not make it a specific crime to file a fraudulent claim, because there are other provisions in the statute. You have to sign,
yes,
swear to your complaint.
False oath.
There are other,
yeah,
provisions to take care of false swearing.
Yeah.
Is there a limit? What's the limit?
$50,000.
Isn't that the top limit?
Oh,
that's,
yes,
what we did.
We didn't set a maximum limit. I believe the committee said that was negotiable.
You only have $15,000 on the automobile.
Well, we can talk about that when we get to it.
I think we could include it, raise the limit on automobile insurance.
All right, the next one is the loss must be at least $250. Is there any discussion on that one? Hearing none, that's adjourned.